The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
So you know what they say about well-laid plans. I have a talk prepared for today, which I'm not going to give. In that talk, there's a pointer to the koan that said, setting up the banner of the teaching, establishing the essential meaning. And so I was reflecting on that in relationship to this founding session, which marks the time of year in 1980 when Dada Roshi first came onto this property and, in his world, discovered this place as a potential place of practice. And so I was thinking about that and remembering him saying that when he had first come up to this area with his wife, Yushin, looking for a place, that he had something much smaller in mind. And so I was curious, what exactly did he have in mind? So I reached out to Yushin during the week and asked her, and that with my encouragement and enthusiasm elicited a series of emails, which I hope will continue, in which she's just been talking about those early years and remembering some things, which I'll share some of today. And then somebody in Doksan asked about ancestors, and I thought, okay, well, that just seals it. And I was telling this student that when I first came and started training, that ancestors really meant nothing to me. My own family is very small. I know very little about my extended family. Even my connections with my grandparents wasn't particularly close. And then within a very sort of individualistic society and culture, it just was not a strong presence for me. So when I came into formal training here, and the very first Sunday we're chanting the names of the ancestors, and it just didn't really mean a lot to me. And that in time, it really, by sort of being with my teacher and seeing his relationship with the Buddha, with the ancestors, it got my attention. And it was clear to me that he had a very active relationship that was very meaningful to him. And I didn't really understand that. I mean, intellectually, I understood it, you know, in terms of where this comes from and who's been there before us and how it came down to us. But it really was not, it was fairly distant. So I wanted to talk a little bit today about ancestors, and particularly in our own more immediate lineage. Last night in the Fusatsu, we chanted the names of the Buddha. We chant every morning service a very condensed form of the ancestors. And as you know, the lineage normally, I mean traditionally, is just the direct lineage of mind to mind from the Buddha down to the present day. We have included into that the women ancestors, which is not technically a lineage, but I think of it as our larger lineage of practitioners and teachers, historical teachers who have been present all along and were responsible in their own time for seeking the Dharma and practicing and coming to enlightenment and teaching and helping to, in no small way, allow us to be here today. In a fascicle by Master Dogen on Buddha ancestors, he says, actualizing Buddha ancestors means to bring them forth and to look at them in veneration. It is not limited to Buddhas of the past, present, and future, but it is going beyond Buddhas who are going beyond themselves. It is taking up those who have maintained the face and eye of Buddha ancestors, formally bowing and meeting them. They have manifested the virtue of the Buddha ancestors, dwelt in it, and actualized it in the body. And I would add, and have brought it to us. So how have we come here today? So we can talk about it in terms of our karma, of raising bodhicitta, of our own, within ourselves, our own motivation, wanting to liberate ourselves, to alleviate our suffering, to live this life in the way that we sense is possible, to bring forth compassion. But if you remove Buddhism, Buddha Dharma, from those things, what do you have? A suffering, seeking human being in need of a path. All of those things which are necessary in this path must be present, but without the path, where do they go? What do we do with those yearnings, those desires, those possibilities? And so the path itself must be present for us in every generation, for those who seek to be able to find that path. And that means there have to be teachers who have themselves trained, who have themselves gone seeking, have encountered the way, have trained and given their lives to sentient beings. It means that the Dharma has to be taught. There have to be teachings that we can hear, we can encounter, we can be inspired and moved by, that we can reflect on and practice. It means that training actually needs to be set up. Somebody has to do that, right? There have to be places, somewhere you can go, some place you can put your butt and do this age-old practice. And there needs to be Sangha that has assembled and that is practicing together. In Shinji's talk, she talked about the Warioki as a miraculous event. How much more so is this? That's why there are many sort of examples or images of how rare that is considered to be able to have all of those necessary components or things going within us to be able to actually come to this point. And one example is of in a vast, vast ocean that there is one single tire floating and that a tortoise just happens to come up and stick its head through. How rare it is. Well, the Buddha, by his own words, spoke about how he, before his awakening, before his seeking, was an unawakened bodhisattva. And he himself was subject to everything we're subject to, birth and death, pain and suffering, attachments, desires, not getting what he wanted, disappointments. And he kept going back to the very sources, the causes of those, all of that suffering, to try and alleviate his suffering. Just like we do. That's what samsara is. And he said, what if I don't do that? What if rather I seek that which is not born, that which is free of attachment and desire, that which is liberated? And so he says, at a later time, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth in the first stage of life, and while my parents, unwilling, were crying with tears streaming down their faces. So this belies that story that is told of how he snuck out in the middle of the night. That's also a good story. So you can have both. But here, he's leaving, and his parents know he's leaving. And they're not happy about it. He said, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. Having thus gone forth in search of what might be skillful, seeking the unexcelled state of sublime peace. And so he went and began looking for a teacher. And so it began. And so he taught, he began teaching, he began ordaining those who wanted to dedicate their life to it as he had. And in the beginning, as he says, when people would ask, he would just say, "Oh, monk, come forth." And that was their ordination. And that's often how things are in the beginning. Very simple, very direct, very much face to face. But what happened was more and more people were coming and wanting to do that. And he couldn't manage it all, right? He couldn't be everywhere at once. And so he came to the idea of having some of those who had already been ordained to be empowered to ordain. And so prohibited during the rainy seasons when they would gather and they would build temporary shelters. They were supposed to be, they were bound to be temporary. They had to dismantle them. Well, that didn't last long. You know, if you found a really sweet place and you've put together a nice little dwelling, it's like, oh, it'd be awful nice to be able to come back to this next time. So very quickly, within the Buddha's lifetime, places of gathering began to form, monasteries, the beginnings of monasteries. And then the Buddha died. After this very, very long, perhaps unusually long teaching career, he died. And before he died, he said, moments before he died, he said, "Now, if the thought occurs to any of you," all of his students who were assembled, who had only known their teacher, the Buddha, as a living, breathing, teaching thing, the source of every sutra, think about that. And now he's dying. They were not happy about that. And he said, "Now, if the thought occurs to any of you that the teaching has lost its arbitrator, we are without a teacher," he says, "do not view it that way. Whatever dharma and vinaya, monastic rules, I have pointed out and formulated for you, that is your teacher after my passing." And then he said, "Now I exhort you, all conditioned things, all fabrications are subject to end and decay. Reach consummation through heedfulness. Realize your self nature. Be diligent." And that was his last word. And so that was the first passing from one generation to the next. Person to person, teacher to disciple, in presence, in person, face to face. And in every period, at every place, in every training hall, within every sangha, this lineage of ancestors has come down to us, teaching, hearing, practicing. And so we too, now, right now, are part of that miraculous net. And traditionally, ancestors is understood as teachers, those who are maintaining the Dharma, continuing the lineages. But if we think of all of us as practitioners of the Dharma, because teachers alone would not continue the Buddha Dharma, right? A teacher without a student is not a teacher. All of us together are part of that net of Buddha Dharma. And if we think of not just our own lineage, but all of the lineages, not just within the Zen tradition, but within all traditions of Buddha Dharma, Japan, China, Korea, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, Burma, India, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, all of this Mahasangha of all being this miraculous net that has come down to us because in every time there have been people like us who are unwilling to just accept samsara, who are born into a world in which samsara is the basic way of going forth, and at some point have decided, no, this cannot be all there is, and have sought another way. And if we think of all of those people, and we should think of them as people, they're just people, right? And in their own times, facing their own challenges, societally, culturally, I mean, just think of all the stuff that has been going on in this world for centuries. Wars and famines, invasions, droughts, plagues, fires, and also times of abundance and peace and plenty and support. But that the hardships that so many of our ancestors experienced, most of which we'll never know, and we'll never actually know, in the same way that we can't actually know another's hardship. But that within all of that, that there were those who continued, and sometimes at great peril, sometimes losing their actual lives. And the sacrifices that had to be made. And how because of some of those, we don't have to. I mean, think about the Buddha and his period of years within the ascetic austerities, right? Because he did that and he examined that, he went as far as he could go with that, and he realized, no, this is not a viable path, which is another way of saying, we don't have to do that, right? He sort of did that for us, if we were so tempted. And so that hardship, those sacrifices that he made, not only helped him, of course, but they, in a very real sense, have been brought down to us. And at the same time, we can think of how all of those ancestors were living and practicing and teaching within their own time, within their own conditioning, social conditioning. And that while enlightenment helps us to see into the nature of reality, it doesn't automatically make us understand all of our socialization. The Buddha taught clearly about the illusory nature of the caste system, for instance, and about the equality of women and men in their capacity to realize Buddhahood. But he wasn't trying to dismantle the caste system. And when he reluctantly admitted women into the Sangha, he gave them 8 burdensome rules that put them into a decidedly second-class position within the Sangha. We can't change those past actions, but we can change the karma that has come down to us based in those. We can do things differently. So if we think of how in each period, you know, that there's an evolution, you know, that we look back on our previous generations, our parents' generations, and we see the things that are shining examples, and we see the ways in which, I don't want to go that way. We look back and we see the ways in which, from our perspective, previous generations seem to have been limited or bound by their constraints or their lack of understanding or ability to see into and through. And so we learn from that, and that way we can evolve, and we can evolve within the Buddha Dharma in the same way. But at the same time, what do we not see? What will successive generations look back upon us and say, why didn't they get that? Of course, Dada Roshi studied primarily with Mizumi Roshi, and Mizumi Roshi was one of those early pioneers, those early first generation Asian teachers who came and brought the Dharma here and began teaching and transmitting it to us in the West. His father, he grew up in a temple, which was very common within the Soto school in Japan. He had quite a number of brothers, most of whom were priests like him. And when he was young, his father sent him to study with Koryu Roshi, who was a very well-known lay Rinzai master, which was kind of unusual because he was of another sect of Zen. And at that time, those sects were quite not the same. And there was a lot of sectarianism between them. So the fact that his father sent him to study with Kotori Roshi, and he lived with him while he was in college, began doing koan study with him, studied with him as a teacher while he was studying Asian literature and philosophy, getting degrees. And Kotori Roshi was studied with a Rinzai master, Joko Roshi, who was distressed at what he saw within the Rinzai lineage monastic tradition. And he asked his disciple, Kotori, to not ordain. He wanted to. And he said, I want you to not ordain, because he just felt like the priestly Rinzai school was not healthy. And so he didn't ordain. And so he taught as a lay teacher. And he emphasized lay practice and led sessions on an ongoing basis. So Mizuma Roshi studied with him. And then he was also able to study with Yasutani Roshi, who was a very important figure in Western Buddhism, particularly American Buddhism, teacher of Kaplow and Eiken Roshi and Edo Shimano and Mizumi. And Yasutani Roshi was somewhat of a controversial figure. He was very, very well respected. He was considered to be very clear. He's very passionate, but he could also be very fierce. If you look at his photograph, you can see it. And so he was criticized for the way he criticized a lot of what he saw going on. In a similar vein, he thought that a lot of what was happening in Soto school in Japan was not healthy, was not vibrant, was becoming calcified. He grew up very, very poor. His mother was very poor, but she was very devout, and she used to help out an old elderly nun, Buddhist nun, and her practice was chanting the Heart Sutra, and so she would chant it over and over and over using a mala bead. And when she became pregnant with Yasutani Roshi, not yet Roshi, but... the nun gave her the beads from her own rosary and told her to swallow it, and that would ensure a healthy birth. So she did that. And then she told the young Yasutani, as he was a young boy, the story that when he was born, he was born clutching that bead in his fist. And of course, he was very moved by that. And then when he went to college and studied biology, he thought, wait a minute. He said, but she was so adamant. So he also was a teacher of monks for a while, but then he gave it up for similar reasons, because he was dissatisfied, disgruntled with what was happening within the monastic path. Perhaps not unsimilar to what drove Dogen to China, where he was unhappy and felt like he was not finding a teacher that he wanted to study with in Japan at that time. And so he taught lay practitioners and held hundreds and hundreds of sessions and regular zazen practice and gave teachings. And then he came to the U.S. to teach at the invitation of some of his students. And that's how he encountered Mizumi Roshi. And Mizumi Roshi came to the States to work at the Zen Mission in Los Angeles, where he was working primarily with the Asian Japanese-American community. Not so much teaching formal Zen or doing formal Zen practice, but teaching, giving teachings that were meaningful to them as lay practitioners, performing ceremonies, funerals, marriages, and so on. And so he did that while he was continuing his own training with Kori Roshi and meeting Yasutani Roshi, began doing also study with him. And they were both Rinzai, teaching within the Rinzai lineage, but different lineages. He was also translating to earn extra money. He wrote fortune cookies. I thought, where are those fortunes? Don't you want to see those? He was a gardener. And then in the 60s, American students started coming up, coming to Zenshuji, to the mission, because it was a Zen place, having read a little bit about Zen and wanting to encounter it. And but there was no place to sit. There was no formal Zazen. And so they made an appeal. And so Mizumi Roshi began in a basement room, began holding meditation. And that was really the beginning. And there were some of the very early people like Bernie Glassman, Tetsugen, Charlotte Beck, Choko, who came and were really that first wave of people who not only came to study with him, but were really instrumental in helping him to do what probably would have been very difficult for him to do alone, because he, you know, he was studying English. It said that after the war in Japan, the American soldiers used their family temple to house anti-aircraft missiles. And so he used to hang out with the soldiers, and he learned to talk. Dadaroshi said he learned to cuss, and he learned to smoke cigarettes and drink beer. Very important exports from America. And so he was a monk. He'd spent his whole life in a temple. I can only imagine it would have been very difficult for him to just launch himself and create a Zen center. So these early students were really key in sort of being those people who helped to sort of, I'm imagining, sort of bring forth a vision. Encountering Mizumi and feeling the strength of his teaching, seeing the possibility, bring that forth and actually make it real. And so it said that on the entrance to that door at Zenshuji, there was a sign that he put up that said, "If you want to clarify the great matter of life and death, you are welcome. Otherwise, better get out." And so more and more people started coming, and it just got too small, so they eventually moved into an apartment and then to a house, and that was the beginning of Zen Center Los Angeles on Normandy Avenue. And in the beginning, they had a very small handful, very small, just like Dadaroshi began with here. But then before, you know, long, they had 100 people sitting. And if you've been to Zen Center Los Angeles, you might want to try and imagine, how was that possible? It's not a large space. And, you know, when we hear these stories, we hear about the teachers, we hear about, you know, those who were teaching. But again, we have to, you know, it's almost a disservice in a way to tell the story, because the story conveys this is what happened and this is who made it happen. And that's not true. It's certainly not the whole truth. No one does anything on their own. And that those stories can't convey not only the 100,000 efforts, the endless, endless efforts that were made, and with difficulty. Remember, this is a while back. Buddhism was not cool, or it was cool in a limited way to a limited number of people. And often in a way that had little to do with Buddhism. There was a lot of ideas. There was no internet. It's like, how do people find out? And what is it? And think of these teachers who are trying to establish something with a sangha that they're entirely dependent upon, who know next to nothing about anything related to Buddhism. And then just paying bills, for instance. Simple things. And so when we hear these stories, we really need, and that's part of why I wanted to talk about this, and why the monastics have been talking about wanting to sort of have a project of gathering our history. You know, we've got it in bits and pieces, but there will be a time where no one's alive anymore who was alive at the beginning. No one was there, right? And I think that one of the reasons it's important to capture that, to have that recorded, is so that when people come here, they realize, oh, it wasn't always like this. Sangha house, Jizo house, lift, you know, four different kinds of fruits in the, you know, a different porridge every morning. Like, we like, what's the big deal? Like cars where everything works? Where bills get paid? It must have always been like that. Cool. Yushin told me that, or it was communicated to me, that when she and Daroshi first came with Asian, their young son Asian, to New York to help Tetsugen set up the Zen community in New York in Riverdale, that he knew already that he wanted to help him do that and then come to the Catskills and establish a place. And the arts in his mind were to be prominent because he was a photographer and that was a very important entry for him into Buddhist practice. And so they started to come up to this area where he had spent years and years growing up and as a young man and hiking and canoeing here and in the Adirondacks. And he loved the area. And she says they drove up to Kingston and stayed, she says, in that dump of a motel. It's still there. I know the one she's talking about. Near the thruway, and met with an old friend named Neil Curry, who took them to a couple places they wanted to look at. One was on Route 212, an old farmhouse. And she said Dada was very, very enthusiastic about that. And while they wanted to talk about it, and so Asian was sleeping because he was just a young child, and they met up with Neil over at the La Duchess Inn, which is no longer here, but used to be just on Miller Road here before it burned down, and we're talking about the possibilities, and all the while, it sounds like, or I'm filling in the pieces, Dido's looking across the road here. What is that place? What is that place? And so she said for several weeks, they came back and forth looking, and then on one, she says, lovely teaser of a spring day, kind of like today. They drove up, left the car at the end of the drive, and walked the property, opening the windows to get in. And of course, this is the famous story of the break-in, where they had to open the windows to crawl in, and the floor in the basement, in the dining room, was filled with water. The roof was leaking. As she says, it was a mess. And it was cold. You can just imagine, in March, it was cold all the way through. And then she said, as they were walking around, they saw in the garden, now this is a story I'd never heard, they saw in the garden was a man sitting there. And so they walked over there, and it was Harold Haar, who was the sort of the patriarch of the Haar family and of the Lutheran camp that had been here and was here and had run this place as a camp for a number of years with his family. And she said Harold was in distress. He didn't know what to do because they couldn't really keep the camp anymore. It wasn't working. It was too expensive. It was too hard to run. But he didn't know what to do with it. And so Yushin took Asian down to the river and enjoyed the Asopus while Dido and Harold talked. And several hours later, she came back. They got in the car and were driving away. And Dido said, well, I just bought the place. It will be a Zen art center. And she said, what? And who do you think is going to clean that big old house? And he said, we'll work it out, Yushin. Don't worry. And so he, as he said, he only had a mailing list of his photography students. He had been teaching photography for a long time. And so he started to call upon them, and he visited a photography school nearby where a friend of his and a co-photographer was living. And they decided at the end of that day to collaborate and create the Zen Art Center, where that photography school and this place would work together and bring in photography and the arts, and Dida would teach the Dharma. And then she says they started getting to work, calling banks, trying to get loans. She said they contacted Lex Hickson. Some of you may remember he had a radio program on WBAI in the city. I think it was called In the Spirit. It was very, very well known, where you get all kinds of spiritual people. And so they had him invite Dido and Maizumi. And while they were on the air talking about this place and Zen, Yushin was receiving phone calls, because they gave them a phone number, her phone number. She was receiving phone calls to take names and addresses for the brochure that they would send out right away that had not yet been made. And that's how things worked for a long time. She says over 2 hours, she took 100 calls, and then they moved in. And she said one day they were here setting everything up, and a friend walked in with a Buddha under his arm and gave it to Dido. That Buddha. One of the residents, who was a musician and a drummer, scrounging around, brought down a drum, cleaned it up, hung it up in the hallway. And one person at a time, people just showed up. She said one day a guy drove in that they had known from Dido's photography school with a big van that said flooring on the side. She said she runs out and says, come here, I want you to look at something, because this floor is a mess. Not this floor, but the one underneath it. And that's really how things worked. And if there was somebody to take care of something, then they jumped in and took care of it. If there wasn't anybody to take care of it, sometimes if it was urgent, we took care of it. It was taken care of the best way we could. And literally with whatever was available. And sometimes things were not taken care of because there just was no means. And people came. You know, I remember Dada Roshi once saying that a teacher can only teach and sort of bring forth and establish this banner and teach and develop a vision of what can be in a way that's equal to who shows up, right? A teacher can have big vision, but there's no one there to enact it. And it took me a long time to really understand how true that is and how, in that way, how profoundly important who shows up is. And not just people with skills, but everyone, because everyone in their own way is making this not just work, but making it possible. And if we do this well, you know, what some of those examples of Maizumi Roshi's teachers is saying to us is that we actually have to protect not the Dharma, but Dharma practice. We have to protect how we take it up, how we engage it. We have to protect what training is. Because in every time there are forces that are actively working to diminish it, to dismantle it, to make it simpler, to make it less. In a sense, to make it more accessible almost always means, to some degree, you have to take some things away. And so within our own forces of consumerism and individualism, our legacies of racism and patriarchy, the way we commodify everything, our impatience, our expectation that we should get whatever we want now. Now, the expectation that, and that because we have broken the Zoom door open, right? And that was exactly the right thing to do during this pandemic, and we are keeping it open, that's changing things. And it's changing things in really good ways, and it's changing things in other ways. And we need to watch that. We need to be careful that we need to think about that. And of course, the thing is, we don't always know the effects of an action. Short term, long term. We usually look short term. What's the long term effect of things? Because no one action is acting in isolation. It's acting within other forces. It's a complex system. I can't decipher all that. I can't predict. But we can do the best we can to, first and foremost, understand the Buddha Dharma and know how we came to understand it. How do we come to understand it? To know the profound potential of Buddha Dharma to alleviate suffering, to transform lives in ways unimaginable. And to stay close to that. Because those ways are ancient. And they're also here. And there's a reason for that. Because we haven't really changed, us human beings. We have the same mind the Buddha had. We have the same desires. They may have somewhat different objects, but probably not really. And so how do we do our best to ensure that in generations to come, people will sit here? And feel gratitude that there were those before them who endured hardships, we've had some, who have sacrificed things, who have persevered under duress, who have also thrived, who have used what was available to them and tried to improve, evolve, to take all of the good that we received from our ancestors and move it forward, not to improve the Dharma, but how we train today for us in our time. We can't change past actions, but we can receive all that we've been given. And within this Dharma, understand as deeply as we can. And that's, in a sense, what I hope every one of you have avowed, is to take this as deeply as you can. See how far you can go within this Dharma, within your own life, for you and for everyone else. Because that vow is completely open-ended. And it is a vow based in faith and confidence and possibility. I'll let my Zuma Roshi offer us the last words. Life after life, birth after birth, never falter. Do not let die the wisdom seed of the Buddhas and ancestors. Truly, I implore you. Someone who speaks like that understands something. To hear that urgency, they have experienced something and they want it for us.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.